Sometimes we will play a little mental game that I call, what would you do if you were president? Sometimes that has come up as a topics question in men's clubs or other speaking clubs. What would you do if you were faced with the problems or the issues that the president is faced with? To me, it's pretty painful to look at what is happening in our world, not just in the United States, but other nations as well. When you look at the kind of leadership there is, leaders who are obviously completely ignorant of God's way, of God's law, and they make their decisions based on their own ideologies and philosophies and politics, their own goals, whatever they feel is important, without any regard to anything on a spiritual level. I have trouble watching the news very much anymore. I generally, if I watch one of the more liberal newscasts, it just makes you a little bit crazy when you hear some of the things that they are saying. If you watch one of the conservative cable channels, I guess there's really only one, but if you watch that one very much, still, it's just kind of, your blood just starts to, if not boil, then at least get a little, at least simmer. When you see the things that are being decided and the way things are being done, it almost seems as if they're purposely trying to do things that just are not right or proper or helpful. But what would you do if you had that authority? Someday you might. Someday you very possibly will. What kind of a leader, what kind of a king would you be? The first king of Israel was put into that position a little bit like the way we find ourselves being called into God's church. He was pretty much an ordinary man living his life and no particular plans beyond what he was doing. God certainly must have seen in him some qualities and characteristics that he could use, and he gave this man every opportunity to succeed in the role of king. This man didn't seem to have a lot of ambition as far as being a leader was concerned. He seemed perfectly content managing his father's donkeys. And he was a farmer and worked with livestock, and he really didn't have, it seems, much ambition beyond that. But God chose Saul to be Israel's first king. And it was a nation that was in desperate need of a strong leader, of one who could help the nation to resolve serious problems and difficulties, to deal with enemies that were continuing to pester them. It was a situation where wisdom was necessary and a good, strong leader would have been ideal. And of course, as I said, God gave Saul every opportunity to succeed. But as you know the story already, it really didn't work out so well. Not for Saul and not for Israel. What can we learn from that? What can we learn from Saul's example? We can certainly understand some of the problems that he had and that he created, and we can see some principles that we can apply in our lives. So the title of the sermon this afternoon is Lessons from the Life of Saul. We've talked recently in a couple of previous sermons about the time of Samuel and his background and his how he came to be in his position as the prophet and the spiritual leader, basically a judge, the last judge who had responsibility to lead Israel. And we've talked a little bit about his background, about some of the events in Israel during the time during his time, and how they chose, the people of Israel wanted to have a king rather than to have just a judge and God to be ruling over them. They wanted to be like the other nations and have a king. We might just review quickly the way Paul, or the way that Samuel described that, what would be the result of that in 1 Samuel chapter 8. This was the choice of the people of Israel. This is what they wanted. They wanted to have a king. Then God told Samuel, don't be too offended by this. They haven't rejected you, they've rejected me. And so the people made that choice. Samuel says in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 10, said this, spoke the words of the Eternal to the people who had asked for a king. He said to them, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. You want a king? Okay, here's what it's going to be like to have a king. He'll take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. Some will run before his chariots. In other words, an army. And those who would provide that armed force on behalf of the nation. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, and will set to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. In other words, the economy of the nation was going to change because of the needs and because of the actions of a king. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. You know, take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He'll expect that most everything in the nation will be revolving around him to provide for his needs. He'll take a tenth of your grain and your vineyards and give it to his officers and servants. See, if he's going to have all these folks working for him and his government, he's going to have to pay them. So this tenth is a tax, which is, of course, above and beyond any tithe. The people wanted it, so here's what they're going to get. So they'll pay this tax to their king to finance his staff and his needs. He'll take your male servants and your female servants, your finest young men, your donkeys, and put them to his work. He'll take a tenth of your sheep, and you'll be his servants. And you'll cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Eternal will not hear you in that day. So it's a pretty sober warning. You want to have a king? Here's what it's going to be like to have a king. And you're not going to like it when you have all of the when you see what it all means. A whole different level and layer of bureaucracy and a financial need was created when this human government was imposed upon them. Israel hadn't thought that through, it wouldn't seem. They wanted just an icon. They wanted a man who was a strong, impressive leader to they could look to and they could see as a hero and a champion. But there was much more involved in that choice than they had considered. So Samuel gave them the warning. And still it says in verse 19 that the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, yeah, we'd like one of those anyway. I'll take one of those. And so they decided that they wanted to have a king. And that our king, it says, may judge us and go before us and fight our battles. So God, as we've talked about, gave them a king. Chapter 9, verse 27, we see where Saul is selected to be their king. You can read, I'm not going to read a lot of the story flow here. It's an interesting and easy story to read. When you do that, you may want to have a more modern translation or a commentary to help you sort out some of the details and understand just what the story flow is. But it's not complicated. It's not difficult to read, to understand. We come to chapter 9, verse 27, after Saul and his servant had come and sought out Samuel to help them find some donkeys that they'd been chasing around that had escaped from Samuel's father's farm, from Saul's father's farm. And they'd come to Samuel, and Samuel had been told by God that this was the man, that Saul was the man who would be chosen to be the king of Israel. So as they were going down, that is after this visit was concluded and Saul and his servant were headed back home, as they were going back down to the outskirts of the city, Samuel said to Saul, "Tell the servant to go ahead of us," and he went on, "but you stand here a while, that I may announce to you the word of God." Now, there's really no indication that Saul was prepared for someone to announce to him personally God's will or God's direction in his life. It must have come to Saul as quite a shock, quite a surprise that this man that he knew to be a prophet had a personal message for him from God. So then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on Saul's head and kissed him and said, "Is it not because the Eternal has anointed you commander over his inheritance?" Yeah, give a little thought to how Saul must have felt at that moment. "I'm just looking for some donkeys. I stopped to see the prophet in case he might be able to help me find these wandering livestock. And now you take me aside and tell me that God has said that I'm to be anointed as commander over the people of Israel." Now, certainly from a human point of view, you have to consider that there must have been quite a shock to Saul to have been given that message, to be given that indication. And then what follows here in chapter 10, the next several verses, are a series of signs that Saul would encounter on his way home that would help him to understand that this really was from God, this really was what was happening, because these unusual things would take place, and Samuel told him beforehand that they were going to happen. So Saul went back to his home. One of his family members, in verse 14, his uncle asked him, "Hey, what's happening? Where'd you go? What was up?" And Saul just gave him a kind of a half answer. He didn't give him the full answer. He said, "Well, we were looking for the donkeys, and they're okay." And so he left it at that. And that he told his uncle that Samuel had helped them to find the donkeys, or that they had been found. So Saul, in a very private and personal moment, was told that he would be the king over Israel. The next step was for the people of Israel to know who their king was. So Samuel called the people together at Mizpah, and he was going to announce to them or have them understand the selection process for the king. Mizpah, we'll come across a couple of other communities as well as we continue, Gibeah, Mizpah, a couple of others, and they're all in the general vicinity of Jerusalem. Actually, at this point, Jerusalem wasn't Jerusalem yet. Jerusalem was a city called Jebus, and it was inhabited by Jebusites. It wasn't until David's time that he conquered that area and established Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel. But we can use that as a landmark because I think most of you could find Jerusalem on a map pretty easily. So these villages are in that same vicinity as Jerusalem. So Samuel called the people to Mizpah, and he said to them, "Thus says the Eternal God of Israel, I brought Israel out of Egypt and delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians, from the hand of all the kingdoms, and from those who oppressed you. But you have today rejected your God, who himself saved you from all your adversities and your tribulations." And they said, "No, set a king over us." So that's what we're going to do. So once again, Samuel reminds Israel of what they were doing here. They wanted a champion. They wanted a hero. They wanted someone who would save their people. God's already done that. He's proven that he will do that for you. But you want a king? Okay. God says you can have a king. So Samuel chose from the tribes of Israel. There was some kind of a process of elimination by lot. However that exactly was administered, we're not sure. But by this series of kind of yes and no answers, it became clear that the king would come from the tribe of Benjamin. And then they went through the families of Benjamin and narrowed it down further to the family of Matri. And then Saul, who was of that family, was chosen by God through this systematic process to be the king. And so he was announced to the people as the one who would be the king over Israel. And verse 24, the people were excited when he was introduced to them, and all the people shouted and said, "Long live the king." And so immediately, most of the people, or at least many of them, bonded to him, and he was just by proclamation, by assignment, the one that they began to look to, and already they viewed him as their king. Verse 25 is also interesting. It says that Samuel explained to the people the behavior of royalty and wrote it in a book and laid it up before the Eternal. And we saw back in chapter 8 the warning that Samuel had already given to the people of what it would be like to have a king. But of course, again, this was a nation that never had a king before. And so they needed to have some structure. What are the king's responsibilities? How are the people to relate to him? And what are they to do? What authority does the king have? And so a structure was laid out. And it's just referred to here as the behavior of royalty. The rights and the duties of the king, the regulations that he could enforce, the way that the people were to respond and relate to him. This was all laid out so that the people would understand, and so that as their king and those who would follow would take up their responsibilities, there would have been a structure laid out for them to follow. And this is laid up before the Eternal, it says. In other words, this was an official document that was probably placed in the temple, or in the tabernacle, I should say, at this point, in the tabernacle, because it was something that would, again, define, it was almost like a contract that defines the relationship between this new government and the people. And it is of God, so that the people would be realize that this is something that he had a hand in or that he gave to them. And it was almost like documentation of their choice. This is what you want? Okay, here are the rules.